This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Britain on Saturday acclaimed a historic action plan by G7 nations to prevent future pandemics as the group showcases U.S.-led unity against China and Russia at its first in-person summit in almost 2 years. Collective steps include slashing the time taken to develop and license vaccines, treatments, and diagnostics for any future disease while reinforcing global surveillance networks. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is welcoming the health pack, and he says the UN agency will examine a British proposal to create a global pandemic radar to send early warnings of future outbreaks. However, aid charity Oxfam said the declaration, quote, does nothing to address the fundamental problems that are preventing vaccines being accessible to the vast majority of humanity. The declaration will be finalized Sunday, according to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, as he chairs the second day of a three-day summit. The G7, Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United States are largely focused on, quote, building back better after COVID-19 wrecked economies and claimed millions of lives around the world. The White House says U.S. President Joe Biden will hold a solo news conference after meeting his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin next week, denying a chance for the two to share an international stage. Putin held a 2018 news conference with Donald Trump, leading to shock when the then U.S. president cast doubt on the findings of his own intelligence agencies and flattered the Russian leader. Biden will meet Putin on June 16th in Geneva for a summit, and the White House has said Biden will bring up ransomware attacks from Russia, Moscow's aggression against Ukraine, the jailing of dissidents, and other issues. This is VOA News. Algeria held parliamentary elections on Saturday that the ruling establishment hopes will turn a page on political unrest amid a crackdown on dissent, but early indications suggest few people were voting. 2 years after mass demonstrations forced a veteran president to step down in Algeria's biggest political crisis for decades, the authorities are still struggling to quell the protest movement. Saturday's vote follows a presidential election in 2019 and a referendum on an amending constitution last year, but many Algerians still think real power is wielded by the army and security forces. Talks between Iran and global powers have restarted in Vienna with the goal of trying to restore a landmark nuclear agreement that the Trump administration abandoned in 2018. Senior diplomats from China, Germany, France, Russia, and Britain plan to meet Saturday at a hotel in the Austrian capital. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled a willingness to rejoin the deal under terms that would see the United States scale back sanctions on Iran and Iran abide by limits on nuclear activity. Saudi Arabia announced Saturday it will allow 60,000 residents vaccinated against COVID to perform this year's Hajj, but Muslims from abroad will be barred for the second straight year. The Hajj is a must for able-bodied Muslims at least once in their lives and typically packs millions of pilgrims into congested religious sites and could be a major source of contagion amid the coronavirus pandemic. This year it would be, quote, open for nationals and residents of the kingdom, limited to 60,000 pilgrims, the Hajj ministry said, according to the official Saudi press agency. The pilgrimage is scheduled to be held in July and will be limited to those who have been vaccinated and are aged 18 to 65 with no chronic illnesses, it said. Only up to 10,000 Muslims took part in the Hajj in July last year, a far cry from 2.5 million who participated in the five-day pilgrimage in 2019 before the pandemic. And Britain's Queen Elizabeth viewed a scaled-down military ceremony at Windsor Castle to mark her official birthday Saturday, her first since the death of her husband, Prince Philip, 2 months ago. The 95-year-old monarch was accompanied by her cousin, Prince Edward, the Duke of Kent, for a socially distanced version of the Trooping the Colour, a ceremony which has been staged for more than 260 years. The event comes a day after the Queen hosted leaders of the Group of Seven Rich Nations for a reception in Cornwall, southwest England, where they're holding a three-day summit. On Sunday, the Queen will also meet U.S. President Joe Biden and his wife Jill for tea at Windsor before he heads off for further meetings in Europe. Find more on these stories and the rest of the day's news at voanews.com. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
For us in the People's Democratic Party, we do not believe in secession, which is the campaign for which Lai Mohammed was making reference to. And as a political party that is responsive and responsible, we cannot support secession in Nigeria.
The Nigerian main opposition party calls on Western countries to impose visa restrictions on senior government officials for stifling free speech.
During President Magufuli's time, he told them that I'm giving you a car, I'm giving you a salary, I'm giving you everything, any other benefits, and then you go and announce that somebody from the opposition won. You won't be in the office. And that's what happened in the 2020 election.
Tanzania's main opposition party reminds President Samia Suluhu Hassan to keep her promise to meet representatives of opposition groups.
We need improvement on the deal so that it addresses the concerns that we have. So I have written to our country's leader, the president of our country, and I'm hopeful that he will see me very soon so that we usher out what we think can be improved in this deal.
And Namibia opposition lawmakers reject agreement between the Namibian government and Germany over genocide committed in the southern African country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, is calling on Western countries, including the US and the UK, to impose visa sanctions on President Muhammadu Buhari and senior government officials for stifling free speech. This after the PDP says recent decisions taken by the administration has weakened the tenets of democracy. The party argues that visa restrictions against cabinet ministers, including Information Minister Lai Mohammed, will serve as a deterrent. The call follows the government's suspension of Twitter's operations in Nigeria. The ban has been condemned by both civil society and opposition groups. They say this is yet another attempt by the government to weaken constitutional guarantees of free speech. The administration rejects the accusation. Information Minister Lai Mohammed says the social media platform is being used to threaten Nigeria's corporate existence. Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the opposition PDP. He tells me that Western countries must act by imposing sanctions on the president and his top officials. He says this will send a strong message that they will not tolerate actions that undermine the constitution.
The People's Democratic Party holds that President Muhammadu Buhari, his Minister of Information, Alhaji Lai Mohammed, as well as the Minister of Justice and Attorney General Malami are responsible for the stifling of free speech in Nigeria. And as such, they should no longer be accorded visas to the United States and other Western world where democracy is upheld as a way of living. Our party holds this position because in over 20 years, we have accepted democracy as a norm. Unfortunately, in the last 6 years of President Muhammadu Buhari, all the institutions of democracy are being destroyed. And we do not think that the United States, the United Kingdom, and other parts of the Western world should encourage President Muhammadu Buhari and his administration to continue to bastardize the democratic process.
Bakola, supporters of the administration are of the view that this call is an invitation to an interference by foreign powers in the internal affairs of Nigeria. They call it very unpatriotic. How do you respond to that?
It is totally incorrect and a misplaced view for anybody to call that an interference. We believe that the United States has a responsibility and a duty to encourage the institutionalization of democratic tenets, particularly in nations where they make developmental contributions and they are friends to. And as such, if they encourage democracy in Nigeria in particular, why should they not also be interested in ensuring that the country practices the tenets of democracy? So our demand as a party is not out of place. We didn't call for sanctions on Nigeria. We are saying that those who are destroying the foundation of democracy in our country should not be allowed to visit countries where democracy is being practiced. That's all.
Kola, some Nigerians are saying the PDP's call is just to score cheap political points, because they said that Lai Mohammed, the information minister, has just announced that Twitter has approached or reached out to Nigeria for dialogue over the suspension. How do you respond to that?
The stance of the People's Democratic Party on our democratic culture goes beyond the banning of Twitter. Twitter can be unbanned. Suspensions can be lifted. But what we are saying as a political party, that's the main opposition political party in Nigeria, is that Mr. President is gradually killing the democratic institution that will engender free, fair, credible election. That Mr. President's attitude towards the electoral process is such that if allowed to persist, even the 2023 election is not guaranteed. We allow Mr. President and his party and their members and their leaders to continue to act ultra vires against the provisions of our law.
Bakola, the information minister is of the view that Twitter has been a platform of choice for separatists and will be disallowed from operating until it is duly registered, licensed, and operates within regulations in Nigeria. Why do you think this is unacceptable?
You must understand that the biggest challenge of the Buhari administration is that it is very poor on feedback mechanism. They do not have a connection with the ordinary Nigerians, and they do not know what the situation is. For us in the People's Democratic Party, we do not believe in secession, which is the campaign for which Lai Mohammed was making reference to. And as a political party that is responsive and responsible, who cannot support secession in Nigeria.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian Main Opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The chairman of the Tanzania Main Opposition Party, Chadema, says President Samia Suluhu Hassan is being reminded to keep her promise to meet the opposition. This after she responded to a letter from Chadema agreeing to meet leaders of the opposition to address their concerns. But Chadema's chairman, Freeman Mbowe, says the president has yet to keep her word 3 months after replying to the letter. Supporters of the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi say opposition leaders should give the president time and space. They are urging the opposition to be mindful that she is addressing a number of challenges facing the country. John Mrema is Chadema's Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols. He tells me that the opposition party wants the president to address 3 key areas of governance, including constitutional reforms, the respect for human rights, and a fresh composition of an independent electoral commission capable of organizing credible future elections.
Our chairman, Freeman Mbowe, wrote a letter to the president almost 3 months now. She responded that she's ready to meet with us, but until today, she haven't done so. And we are moving forward because we thought after the sufferings we've gone through for the last 5 years, we needed to express our concerns to her and even to advise her on how better we think she can run this country on the issues of democracy, human rights, and governance.
But John, some people are suggesting that since she has begun meeting several groups, it's just a matter of time before she meets opposition leaders in the country. So give her a little time. What do you say to that?
We understand that she has started meeting with other groups, but our concern is that she better receive our views. As Chadema, we are the main opposition political party in this country. We are among the biggest groups in this country. We have gone through suffering for so many years, almost 5 years and a half. Our people disappeared. Our people were shot. Our people were killed. And our people, they went bankrupt. We need to tell her so that we think we have something we can share in common. And she can then take our views, meet with other groups, get their concerns. But at the moment, she's meeting with several groups. She addressed them, and off they go.
What are the major issues? Let's say two or three major issues that Chidema wants to discuss with the president.
We have three main key issues to discuss with the president. The first issue is about the constitutional reforms. This country won't move forward with the same constitution we do have today. The second agenda is about the independent electoral commission, because we've made it very clear that without independent electoral commission in this country, 2024, 2025, we Chidema will not participate in general election without independent electoral commission. And the third major issue is about democracy and human rights. Principles of democracy and human rights should be observed in this country.
Officials of the Electoral Commission have been on the record saying they are truly independent. So what do you want to see at the Electoral Commission that will make you satisfied that this institution is really independent, that will organize future elections that will be free, fair, transparent, and credible? Because elections organized by the electoral body have often been touted by your group, Chidema, as not free, fair, credible, or transparent, and even threatening that you will not participate in the next election if it's not independent.
Our electoral commission is not independent at all. The independence of electoral commission depends on various issues. For instance, we have an electoral commission, they don't have a budget. Their budget is under Prime Minister's office. So how independent can you be without the resources? They don't have resources. Secondly, the appointment authority. All members of the electoral commission, they are appointed by the president without consultation of anybody in this country. So a president can wake up in the morning and decide who should be the chairman of electoral commission. They don't have any security of their job. They can be removed from the office any minute the president decides so. On our case, we are saying no. We should make a mechanism of removing these people from the office. We should give them a security as the judges of the High Court. They have a procedure to remove them from the office. But the Electoral Commission members, all of them, from the chairman to all members of the Electoral Commission, they know they don't have any security. What I can tell you, Peter, Electoral Commission body, their employees, it's only about 20 people because they are only at the national level. In the regions, in the districts, in the constituencies, they don't have permanent members of the electoral commission. So it's until election time they will decide. And our election law says that those who should supervise election in the constituency level are the district executive directors, who are the appointees of the president. During President Magufuli's time, he told them that I'm giving you a car, I'm giving you a salary, I'm giving you everything, any other benefits, and then you go and announce that somebody from the opposition won. You won't be in the office. And that's what happened in the 2020 election.
John Brema is Chidema's Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In Namibia, the leader of the minority in parliament has petitioned President Hage Geingob and officials of the German parliament seeking to review the agreement signed between the two governments over colonial-era genocide in the southern African country. Mark Henry Venani and colleagues of the minority in parliament have rejected the agreement. They say funds committed by Germany to help affected communities are inadequate. As part of the agreement, the German government officially apologized for its deadly policies against the Nama and the Herero people, which occurred more than 100 years ago. Tens of thousands of Herero and about 10,000 Nama were killed, tortured, or driven into the desert for rebelling against colonial rule. Berlin agreed to provide 30 years of financial assistance to improve infrastructure, healthcare, and training programs for the ethnic groups who were victims of the genocide. Makere Venani tells me the agreement has to be revisited since it has yet to be ratified by the Namibian parliament.
We recognize that progress has been made, that Germany is accepting a genocide and they want to apologize. But the amount of the reparation or the atonement that they want to settle for is very little. No respectable polity, civilization can really afford to be atoned in such a very low amount. They want to pay 1 billion euros over a period of 30 years, taking inflation into consideration, that money would cost a total real value of over 6 billion Namibian dollar. And these are funds that the Germans are already using to renovate their own castles in Berlin. Are you saying that a decimation and the killing of so many people that have lost land disposition, economic disposition through cattle and livestock, are really worth then a renovation being done in Germany at one of their castles? So we are appealing to the moral conscience of the German leadership. We are appealing to the moral conscience of our own government in this country that we can't settle for such a quantum. Knowing that Namibia is the only country that is a German-speaking African country with a population of only 2.5 million people, we believe that the moral conscience of the Germans must be heightened, that they can do better and they ought to do better in atoning for the wrongs that were done.
So what ball figure is the opposition proposing? Because you are literally kicking against the agreement that the funds being offered by the German administration is not enough. What figure will be enough to satisfy you?
Well, a figure that is enough is anything that is respectable. Of course, we are not pushing for trillions of dollars, but we are saying a respectable figure that would be able to turn around the economic base of the descendants. Because you have to put it in this way, if you want to make a computation of some sort. A life of a Namibian whose parents suffered under the genocide, and you put it with the life of a German citizen who has inherited land that was gotten through disposition. In 30 years, if you help these people in with this amount, well, what would their life be? They would not even be at par with the life of the person who has benefited from the proceeds of genocide. A fair amount should be an amount that addresses the economic upliftment of those communities. And we are saying 6 billion over a period of 30 years would not do that. I have written to the leadership of Germany, to the leader of the CDU, which is the largest party, the leader of SPD, and the leaders of the Greens, to meet them to discuss a possible agreement to find a respectable deal.
With the letter that you have written, how pragmatic do you think that is to sit down with these groups in order to revisit this agreement? Because it looks like it's a done deal. The government has signed it on it. The Nama people said involved.
The documents was initialed by the two governments, but they are not signed. Parliament of both countries must assent to the deal. The German government, the German parliament through the Bundestag, and the Namibian parliament through our National Assembly should approve the deal. At this point in time, the government of Namibia has not presented the deal to our parliament for discussion. They have just provided the deal for note-taking that this is what transpired. So the reason that we are seeking a pragmatic approach, we are speaking to German leaders that has influence over their members of parliament, that when they go into parliament, so that we go and amend. We are not saying because we understand the economic realities of the world, so do we understand that all people are globally are suffering financially to be able to pay up. But I think Germany can do better. Because I can make this very simple argument and say that the German, as a country that has atoned the Jews, they have paid 776 billion over the last 70 years to the Jews. Is it because we are black? So what we are saying to Germany is that Germany can do better and they ought to do better.
Mr. Makary, do you think you have the numbers in parliament to demand what you are asking for? Because it appears SWAPO has a majority that could append their signature to this agreement and it will be a done deal. How do you respond to that?
Well, politics is a game of possibilities and impossibilities. We are appealing to the moral conscience of the SWAPO leadership that we want this deal in the broader and longer interest of all the people of this country. When this motion was adopted by the National Assembly, it was adopted by all parties, including SWAPO. The motion that was brought by Chief Riwako in 2006 was adopted by all parties. We also want this deal to be adopted by all parties in parliament, but we need improvement on the deal so that it addresses the concerns that we have. So I have written to our country's leader, the president of our country, and I'm hopeful that he will see me very soon so that we usher out what we think can be improved in this deal.
Makary Venani is the leader of the minority in the Namibian parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Vinto. In Zambia, the anti-graft organization Transparency International, or TI, is being criticized for launching a campaign that some say is aimed at making the government unpopular ahead of the August 12 general election. This after the Zambia chapter of TI launched the Share Your Story campaign to encourage citizens to participate in the fight against corruption and mismanagement. The organization denies that it has teamed up with the opposition to launch the effort to make incumbent President Edgar Lungu and his governing Patriotic Front unpopular before the polls. Critics questioning the timing of the campaign, saying the president has demonstrated his commitment to fight corruption. But the executive director of TI, Maurice Nyambi, defends the anti-corruption drive. He says it seeks to encourage Zambians to share their personal experiences with graft in a website as part of the effort to combat corruption in the Southern African country. For details about the Share Your Story campaign, I reach Maurice Nyambi in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
So we are basically asking people to share their experiences in terms of, them encountering corruption or any corruption that they have encountered. So they are sharing their stories primarily through a website that we have set up. So the website is www.shareyourstory.org.zm. And through that, citizens and members of the public will be able to share their stories and different experiences around corruption. The idea is that, corruption happens largely in secret. And so because of the war of silence that exists around corruption, people have come to accept it as a norm, as something that is normal. But we are hoping that, once people start talking about their experiences and the more people begin to open up and talk about corruption, then this layer of silence that, covers issues of corruption will actually be pulled back and will begin to show actually that corruption is not normal and that we need to actually start doing something about it in order for us to make progress in terms of addressing it. So essentially that is what the campaign is about.
Maurice, some people are asking about the timing of this campaign. Why now?
So for us, just because we are in an election season does not mean then that the prevalence of corruption has stopped or that corruption has ceased to be a problem until after the elections. That is far from being the case. The fight against corruption is something that we need to integrate even within the context of our everyday livelihood. So everything that we are doing, we should be able to incorporate aspects of fighting corruption within it. But also beyond that, Peter, you will recall that, over the last few months or so, we have seen quite a number of scandals in Zambia in relation to issues of corruption. I mean, the scandal to do with the expired drugs, for example, or the $17 million US dollar contract that was given to a company called Honey Bee Pharmacy, which was not in existence at the time it was awarded the contract. So when you look at all those issues and then coupled by the fact that, Zambia has been declining on the Transparency International Corruption Perception Index. For us, we think that there is no better time to actually launch this campaign than now, because issues of corruption are actually fresh in people's minds.
But Maurice, what do you say to those skeptics who are of the view that this is a carefully orchestrated plan to undermine the popularity of President Edgar Lungu and his governing Patriotic Front Party? This, they said, is an opposition ploy that you have teamed up with them to make them unpopular in the run-up to the August 12th general election. How do you respond to that?
Well, I can categorically state that this is not an orchestrated move to make any single person or any single political party unpopular. And, there are no political connotations attached to this. So we are not working with any political grouping or any political entity. I also need to mention that, this is not something that has just come from without or from nowhere. You will recall and you will know that as Transparency International Zambia, we have been involved in different interventions that look at, fighting corruption or raising awareness around issues of corruption. And one of the lessons that we have learned from all these years that we've been doing this work is that there's always always this desire for citizens to be involved somehow in the fight against corruption. But I think the biggest problem has been that there have not been any platforms that we have created to actually enable citizens to get involved in real and meaningful ways in the fight against corruption. So for us, we are seeing this as an opportunity to actually provide a practical platform through which citizens can be able to engage and actually share their stories around issues of corruption. Corruption affects all of us, and therefore interventions that are meant to fight it should also encompass every one of us. And so citizens will really have the opportunity to be able to share their experiences. And the expectation is that, we are going to get all these stories and maybe be able to learn some things from this. And hopefully that will inform, the sort of interventions that we are going to be involved in even going forward.
Maurice Nyambe is the Executive Director of Transparency International. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the MasterCard Foundation has donated $1.3 billion to help Africa's Center for Disease Control fight the spread of the novel coronavirus. The donation, experts say, will be a significant boost to the continent's fight against the disease. It comes as Africa battles the pandemic with limited resources and works to revive battered economies impacted by COVID-19. Health experts say some countries have to rely on the international community to provide vaccines against the virus. To learn more about the MasterCard Foundation's donation, I reached Rita Roy, the foundation's chief executive officer.
This partnership, as you noted, is to deploy $1.3 billion over the next 3 years in partnership with the Africa CDC, and they'll do four things. First, we will purchase vaccines for up to or at least 50 million people. Second, we will support the deployment of vaccinations across the country. Third, we're going to be focusing on building the long-term workforce capabilities for vaccine manufacturing on the continent. And fourth, we're going to strengthen the Africa CDC and enable it to undertake this huge initiative.
So Rita, what influenced the timing of this decision by the MasterCard Foundation? What influenced the timing?
I think one of the most critical things, which is so hard to ignore, is the growing inequity. The gap between this part of the world, as you know, I live in Kigali right now, versus the rest of the world. Less than 2% of the population of Africa has been vaccinated, in contrast to upwards of 50% elsewhere in the world. The African Union last year set a target of vaccinating at least 60% of the population by the end of 2022. And we just felt that this gap, this inequity, was unbearable, and it required a response.
Are there any benchmarks that the MasterCard Foundation would want to see as it partners Africa CDC in this fight against this global pandemic?
Yes, there are a number of benchmarks. So one, obviously, is the purchase and the deployment of vaccinations to millions of people. And we will be tracking the numbers of people who get vaccinated. That's one. Second is we also see this as an opportunity for employment for thousands of people, hopefully thousands of young people who are going to also be mobilized to stand up vaccination centers, to play different kinds of roles in this very large effort, and we'll be tracking that as well. But most fundamentally, we want to be able to see as vaccinations take hold, the restoration and the recovery of the economy, where people can go about their lives, begin to move about with more freedom to be able to undertake economic activity. As you know, this containment of the virus, which up to now has really relied on restricted movements, a lot of social distancing, which is very, very difficult in this context, has had a huge impact on many economies across the continent.
What has been the responses you've gotten since MasterCard Foundation made this contribution to Africa's fight against the coronavirus?
Well, the response overwhelmingly has been positive. We have heard words like, you know, about time, we want to see more organizations step up. There are others who are joining us as well to say, how can we help? People are very excited that we're focusing on the continent and putting at the center an African public health institution, the Africa CDC, and that we will be working with many African organizations across the continent. So in some ways, it's been a shot in the arm, not to use a pun, of hope. And so we are also gratified and we're humbled. But right now, what's important to us is let's get going and let's focus on the hard work of making it happen.
With this amount that MasterCard has donated to the fight against coronavirus, will you also partner these governments in their effort to revive their economies battered by the pandemic?
So first and foremost, Peter, this effort is going to get behind national vaccination plans. We are not going to create a parallel system to what is happening in each of the countries. Virtually most of the countries across the continent have put together plans for and have actually started implementing vaccinations across their countries. Now, it's been slow. Some of those efforts have been stymied for different reasons. So the focus here is to understand where are those plans right now, what are the critical needs, and how this initiative can assist. So we are actually getting behind national public health institutions as they go about doing this work.
What is the message here to the people of Africa following this donation?
The message, number one, is a message of hope. Second, it's also about getting practical. I would ask everyone, get yourself informed of the facts about this disease, how you can protect your families, how you can continue to stay safe, and also get the facts about vaccine. And when a vaccine is offered to you, take it. Take it to keep yourself safe, keep your family safe, and keep your community.
Rita Roy is the Chief Executive Officer of the MasterCard Foundation. She spoke with me from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Uganda officials are scrambling to find more COVID-19 vaccine as many medical stores have run out of supplies, leaving only enough to last a few days at most. For VOA, Catherine Nambi reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Many were at first reluctant to get the vaccine, but a resurgence in COVID-19 cases over the past few weeks has sparked a dash to get jabbed. Uganda procured 964,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine under the COVAX facility, but medical stores say their stocks are mostly gone. Dr. Alfred Drewali is the program manager of Uganda National Expanded Program on Immunization.
About 90 districts have used all the vaccine stocks they have. We also now know most districts have run out of stock, and those who are holding the balance of vaccines, majority of them are having doses in small quantities.
The shortage coincides with India banning exports of AstraZeneca. Drewali says the government is working round the clock to find another supply of the vaccine as soon as possible.
So we are expecting another consignment of vaccines on 14th of this month, and that can take us for another 1 or 2 weeks, and then the hunt continues for more vaccine doses.
Drewali says the first priority for expected vaccines will be Ugandans who qualify for a second AstraZeneca jab. Uganda is also looking at Johnson & Johnson, Sinovac, and other vaccine options. Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng is Uganda's health minister. She says vaccine shortages are a general problem across Africa. Acheng adds that the government has already ordered more doses.
I want to believe that every African country is worried, not only Uganda, because we are all having difficulty in accessing vaccines, and the government of Uganda has gone ahead to place in orders. To date, the government of Uganda has placed in 5 million through the African Union. Hopefully, we can place in more as resources keep on coming.
Available statistics indicate that only 1.7% of Uganda's population has been able to at least get the first COVID-19 jab. According to World Health Organization, 47 African countries, including Uganda, might fail to meet the target of 10% vaccination of their populations by September. WHO says about 225 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines are needed on the continent urgently amid surges in new cases. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The UN Refugee Agency is repeating its call to Tanzanian authorities to stop forcibly deporting asylum seekers back to Mozambique, where their lives are in danger. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
2.5 months have passed since Islamist militants attacked civilians in the gas-rich coastal town of Palma in northern Mozambique, killing dozens and displacing more than 70,000. While the level of violence has diminished, the UN Refugee Agency says armed conflict and insecurity continue to displace thousands of people. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says people are fleeing daily in a desperate search for safety, both in Mozambique and across the border in Tanzania.
9,600 desperate people trying to seek refuge across the border inside Tanzania and being forced to return to a situation of danger is really grave, and it is a dire situation. Refugees must not be forced back into a situation of danger.
That, he says, violates the principle of non-refoulement or no forced return. International human rights law states that no one should be returned to a country where they would face torture or other treatment that could cause irreparable harm. Baluch says UNHCR teams along the Tanzania-Mozambique border say people being forcibly returned to Mozambique arrive in desperate condition. He says many become separated from their family members, adding to their anguish.
Those pushed back from Tanzania end up in a dire situation at the border and are exposed to gender-based violence and health risks, as many are sleeping in the open at night in extreme cold without blankets or a roof over their heads. There's an urgent need for emergency relief items, including food.
Humanitarian agencies estimate nearly 800,000 people have been displaced in Mozambique's northern Cabo Delgado province since armed groups, some affiliated with Islamic State militants, launched attacks in the region in 2017. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Botswana authorities say HIV infections rose by 33% after the country went into a lockdown to fight the spread of COVID-19. The increase has been attributed to a decrease in condom use, with COVID-19 restrictions affecting distribution. For viewing, Kodisi Dube has the details from the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
The Botswana Government Coordinating Body National AIDS and Health Promotions Agency, NAPA, says 8,860 new infections were recorded in 2020. NAPA Acting Coordinator Robert Siladu says the figure represents a 33% increase recorded particularly among the youth. Siladu told Parliament Thursday that limited condom distribution and use due to the COVID-19 could have contributed to the new infections.
We have managed to distribute over 27 million pieces of condoms, although the distribution has gone down, because in the previous years we've had 41 million pieces that were distributed in 2019 and then 44 million in 2018. So during the period when people were in lockdown, chances are activities were taking place unprotected.
During the first lockdown between March and May last year, Botswana reported a critical condom shortage. This was due to COVID-19 restrictions, with overseas suppliers failing to meet demand. Despite the spike in infection figures, Siladu says Botswana is making progress in reducing transmissions and HIV-related deaths. The latest NAPA statistics show 374,000 Botswana nationals, almost a quarter of the population, are HIV positive. Botswana records nearly 9,000 new HIV infections every year, with 5,000 reported deaths.
Both new infections and AIDS-related deaths are estimated to have reduced by 37% and 22% respectively since 2010. And this is commendable progress. This is largely attributable to biomedical interventions that we have in place, the PMTCT, the ART program, and condom use, and to some extent, but very limited, behavioral change issues.
Despite the reduction in infections and mortality, Silato says the figures are still off the United Nations target, but Botswana has received praise for its HIV interventions, with 95% of the HIV-positive population on antiretroviral therapy, ART. For VOA, this is Mkondi Sidube in Haboroni, Botswana.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Baby,
Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impube, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a hunter who has only one arrow does not shoot with careless aim. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.